Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On this episode of Wandering DMs, I don't know how this happened, but we managed to score very special guest Jeff Grubb, who has, there's a longer biography here, but I'm just going to say a committed writer and designer for role-playing games and novels and video games. And Jeff, we are so happy to have you here today.
I'm glad to be here. I use the term older than dirt usually when referring to
We like honoring the legacy of role-playing games and fantasy novels and everything like that. Now, I have been grappling most of this week trying to get a grip on Jeff's bibliography. And so I think, here comes the most coherent synopsis I could come up with. Is Jeff okay. Has he worked at TSR? You're the creator for the famous original Marvel superheroes role playing game, or Facerf, that a lot of us call it by the system.
Yes,
you're the creator of Spelljammer. You're the creator of the Al Qadim campaign setting. You're the creator of the initial manual of the Planes, which has had a whole bunch of additions later on. Right. And you're really essential to getting Forgotten Realms published as a campaign setting. I think you're the one that actually got Ed Greenwood to agree to actually publish that, right?
I was the poor schlub who said, you know, they were looking for a new world after Dragonlance had been a success. And, you know, basically I said, well, Ed's done all these articles for Dragon Magazine. Let's see if there's something behind there. And as a result, I'm the one who made the phone call. So
amazing, amazing.
Awesome.
And so you've been a really essential writer for Forgotten Realms and Dragonlance and Ravenloft, and you've worked on properties for Warcraft and Starcraft and Star Wars and Thieves mm-hmm. Guild and Buck Rogers and a whole bunch of other
Thieves
stuff
World.
That I can't get right. Mm-hmm. And you've published over a dozen novels, many short stories, whole bunch of video games, and currently you're a narrative designer at Amazon. So there's a whole bunch of other stuff I left out, but anyway, if somebody didn't know who Jeff Grubb was, it might be easier to name stuff that he's not involved with. But that's the best I could do today.
Excellent, a noble effort. So where do we start, Dan?
Okay, I normally have a couple of introductory questions, but there's really big ticket items I want to make sure that we do not miss. And one is, Jeff, among your earliest jobs, and this might be a surprise to our viewers, but among your earliest jobs at TSR, you ran the Gen Con AD&D Open in 1982. And of course, that's super close to our hearts because Paul and I are currently working and producing our other show, The Big Bad, which is a produced celebrity D&D tournament show. And we've spent a lot of time trying to dig into the history of D&D tournaments and how the scoring went and how you ran them and stuff like that. What was that like running the AD&D Open?
Well, first off, I didn't run it. The guy in charge of the AD&D Open was Bob Blake, a pharmacist from Indiana, and he was the guy who pulled it all together and made it work every year for many, many years. I wrote this adventure for in 1982 on the and that's what got me into TSR. I'd gotten into Dungeons and Dragons back in the late 70s, running my own campaign, and I went to school at Purdue University, which was just, you know, down the road from Kenosha. So every year we would come out, my gang, my D&D gang, would come out. We would come out to Lake Geneva. A friend of ours had a house on the lake there. His parents had a house.
Oh, wow.
We'd stay there for a couple days, drive to Kenosha, play D&D for 4 days, then come back, then go to college. You know, it was a really great, nice. great operation. And we got involved in running the D&D Open for several years. So basically we started off running D&D Open. And after one particular, I think it was like 81, we're walking down the hall with one of my friends, and he, who was also a DM, and said, and he was loudly proclaimed, well, that wasn't very good. I think we could write a better D&D Open than that. And Bob Blake was right ahead of us, and he turned around and said, congratulations. You just volunteered to write for next year's. And it was myself, Frank Dickus, Jeff Lieben, and Leonard Lakofka. He was the veteran of the group, and we put together a very a stream of basically, you know, could be broken into seven parts, because we had five adventures that were, I think maybe it was four adventures that were like the first round, then two adventures on Saturday, which were the second round, and then the final was on Sunday. And so we basically strung together a story. It was a quest for material components for the king, that sort of thing. And everybody basically took a different shot at it, and we pulled it together. I was a civil engineer at that time. I had just been laid off, so I had time. So I coordinated the dungeon and got them delivered it in February. Play-tested, all set up, and on the strength of that, I was hired by TSR as a designer. Awesome. So basically, this was my audition. I came in, and I called them every week and basically say, so how are things are going? I got to know the front desk real well, you know, and basically, you know, but do you have any jobs available? And at one point, I was actually, you know, out there for a wedding just down the road in Indiana. I said, I'm going to be in the area. Can I drop in? And I dropped in and did an interview with Alan Hammack, and then was hired. It was insane. It was a really wonderful, but it was on the strength of being able to deliver that project you know, months early, all wrapped up. Everything was so basically, I did a lot of coordination for it, but Bob Blake was the guy who really put it all together.
That sounds like a super exciting experience.
I wouldn't do it again, you know, just because it just sounds so wild and insane. So
let me ask you a question I've always sort of hankered to ask somebody who was there at the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe you know the answer, maybe you don't, but I'm very curious if you have a sense for how much the whole sort of tournament scene impacted the design of the game itself. Was tournaments taken into consideration?
Yes, I mean, GDQ was, you know, a tournament dungeon. The A series was a tournament dungeon. They were expanded out. They were so basically, you know, and a lot of it is you'd have a main line, or they just wouldn't worry about, you know, how to finish. By the time I joined, we had sort of a format down, where you we wanted to have it fit into a four-hour block. The first cut for judging was how far did they get. We wanted to standardize the experience so that, you know, you could so that, you know, the team that plays on Thursday afternoon basically can be judged against the team that plays a different adventure on Friday morning. Because we can't have the same adventure, because people talk and they'll say, oh, yes, there's a mind flayer in this room, and et cetera. So we ended up with and this is, you know, was in the process. We didn't do this for ours because we had a wide variety of stuff. But eventually they standardized to the fact of having a big monster, a group of mixed monsters, an old monster used in a new way. An example of that is the gelatinous cube covered with dust so it looks like a stone block. You know, the non-combat encounter, the encounter you can talk your way around, the small battle, the trick or trap, and there'd be these toggles that we basically would have to hit each one of them, and then put that all together into one story. So a lot of the later, when I wrote Quest for the King, which was the 82 the dungeon. We were all over the point, and you know, Lenny Lukavka had a graveyard that we were wandering through, that sort of thing. And you know, some linear, some non-linear. And as time went by, they standardized what they want to have in the game so they could easily judge it. One dungeon I was running, and it was interesting. One dungeon I ran like the year before or year before that was in the final, the DM started throwing monsters at you, monster after monster after monster, and you only could solve the riddle by telling you the player telling the DM to stop. That was how the game was supposed to basically, and I ended up running what was the winning group, and they basically got so frustrated, like say, okay, now five more orcs are coming in. Okay, now we've got some ogres that show up. Okay, now the walls are starting to move in on you, and they go, okay, stop it, and okay.
You know, it's interesting because that kind of like player puzzly. You know, mm-hmm. like a lot of people would point to that nowadays and criticize that as like, well, that's metagaming. Oh, yeah. You're thinking outside the character. But that was a lot more common at the time of like, you know, we're a game and you're players and you're playing a puzzle.
It was a lot more thrilled common.
Me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing that
of course you're dealing with there, that's the interesting challenge, and the overall design scope sounds, you know, sounds a lot to me like the A-series modules. Was that
right?
Was that before? They're a little bit before.
The A-series was before.
Yeah.
The A-series, gotcha. I think, was before the one I did. So, because that was Harold Johnson. So, who was my boss when I joined TSR.
And it's interesting that you had the additional wrinkle of having to come up with analogous versions of the adventure in separate slots over the course of the weekend. Because, of course, with me and Paul, with the big bad, we don't have to worry about that. We just have one scenario that we wrote.
Although, admittedly, we've discussed that, right? Like, if we ever wanted to do a live version of it, you know, one of the problems is, then the audience from the earlier showing will tell the competitors in the later showing, and then now it's not comparable anymore, right?
You're right.
Exactly.
We have discussed that.
Yeah.
How many people were you serving in the open at that time?
8 to 10.
At one table, but how many people all told through the whole weekend?
Yeah, we were all over Kenosha. I would say there were some 24 DMs, maybe 30.
Gotcha.
And we would have a briefing before. Gotcha. Before the sessions, and we would go through all of it and say, oh, does anybody have any problems? And people would have problems with, you know, how do I handle this encounter? How do I do this? We had one occasion where a young man wanted to go into excruciating detail on each encounter to basically make sure he did it right. And then he TPK'd the party in the first room. Okay, then.
That's on brand. I get that. So it sounds like if you had like 30 DMs and like 5-ish slots over the weekend and 10-ish people per table, that's like on the order of 3,000 players over the course of the weekend. Am I in the ballpark on that?
That sounds about right. 10 to 15. Wait a minute. 10 players per 30 DMs. Yeah. 300 or 3,000.
I think it was
a good number, and this is the AD&D Open was the predecessor to the poly the Gen Con Open was the predecessor to the RPGA,
right?
And basically, they were both running, and they had different styles. The RPGA basically got a little bit more into both doing a little more player character interaction, a little more role playing. As opposed to getting through and fighting the monsters. The open was basically much more that traditional old school sort of thing. But again, when I talk about the idea of the idea we have to have one of each, that's much more a polyhedron idea than what we did back for the open as well.
Gotcha. So it's interesting. I mean, I had the same question that Paul does, is like there are many people that suggest that the overall structure of advanced D&D had as a design goal to support those tournament type games, that was the most important thing at the time of AD&D. Do you think that the AD&D rules were changed, like, in order to support that kind of play, or is that an overblown statement?
I think they grew up together, because when one of the things when I started playing the AD&D Open, when I started running the AD&D Opens, right, what you got was the DMG. That was basically one of the first, second times that I ran a player's handbook DMG. Oh, wow. Basically, that was the reward for the GMs, you know, because we would release the hardbacks at Gen Con. Okay, yeah. I mean, we do one a year. I mean, this is old guy stuff, but you know, we played D&D. We had the little brown box, you know, and I saw the red box and the Holmes Basic and everything, and then the Monster Manual came out, and we tried to figure out how to make that work with, you know, what we had, and then the Player's Handbook came out a year later, so we had a year of playing the game without a Player's Handbook, and then the Player's Handbook showed up, and then everything shifted over, and then a year later the DMG showed up, and the DMG was where all the experience points were for all the monsters from the Monster Manual
volumes, right? You didn't get any combat statistics until you got the DMG, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You got that whole appendix in there that basically, you know, goes through a lot of description about, you know, what they do, right. And so, you know, it was a catch-up feature. So, I mean, kids today, you get all the books released at once, you know, they go 1 month, 2 month, 3 months, and go, no, right, back in our day.
Starting with the Player's Handbook, I mean, what's up with that? You get to make a character to begin with?
We start with, yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's just so easy these days.
It is. Before we get off the tournament thing, I mean, so we were talking before, I mean, so this came up before we actually started the show, because it was among our more interested things. Maybe tell us a little bit about how the scoring went for that, because we know that there was, like, some tournaments, like, before that time, scored the players individually at the table.
Right.
And yes, we certainly prefer the team-based scoring. So how was that working in 82?
It was primarily team-based, and that would make the assumption that if your team qualified in one of the early rounds, you'd have the same group of people for, you know, rounds, you know, 2 and 3. So basically, but it was a team-based advancement. Now, within that group, there was a, you know, choosing the best role player, who was the best player, and that I believe came out of the RPGA as well, because they talked about individual scores at that point, and had a score sheet. The RPGA had a score sheet for a while that basically, you know, was with tick boxes, like, did this character do this? Did he live up to his character? Do you know his alignment? That sort of thing. So yes, originally the main score was for groups that move forward are how far did they get? And this is very basic. You know, these dungeons had a tendency to be linear. You know, how far did they get? How many people were still alive at the end of the session? So these were the things that you looked at initially. And it tended to work. You know, sometimes we'd have to add an extra GM, that sort of thing, just to make it because we had ties and people working together. I mean, literally. And if it was a case of people finishing early, how fast did they do it? Mm-hmm. These are things that the RPG did not pick up, did not play with nearly as much as we did way back, because we're making up as we go along. So, you know, we're discovering what's there. So
great. It's an interesting point that, you know, I've made a number of times, that with that idiom of most of the adventures of the time coming out of tournaments, and the tournaments having possibly thousands of people in them, that you want a very small number of people to actually succeed at it so that you can pinpoint them as the actual winner of the event.
Right.
And then when people use those same adventures in their campaigns, it can be like a crushing meat grinder because it's intentionally S1. Set up that that like one out of 1,000 teams can possibly get through it. And so sometimes I think when younger people are introduced to that stuff, it feels like really like bone crushingly hard.
Ha-ha. S1. Tomb of Horrors. I mean, that's the idea of basically being is there are ones that are tough as possible. There are other ones that base. I thought the A series was, you know, rather good and balanced. As far as for, and also things expanded out as they were developing. I'm thinking about what you said about AD&D, evolving. And like I said, the tournament scene was first, but the one of the reasons for AD&D was a standardization of the rules. We saw a lot of people, John Peterson goes into this in Playing at the World, if you've ever had the chance to read it. Basically,
if any viewer, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if any viewer hasn't gotten John Peterson's Playing at the World, it's one of my most beloved books. I've had a small chance to speak with John Peterson in person, and he's a huge credit to the hobby, and I'm so glad he's doing his work.
He hates it that I keep promoting it. It's actually a book that starts the history of gaming from the dawn of time to 15 minutes before I arrived at my first Gen Con. Literally, it ends like about the time I showed up at the first Gen Con in Kenosha. So it's very interesting. Got a lot of details, but what it points out is that a lot of different groups, particularly the West Coast, basically were evolving their own forms of D&D, their own methods of play, and that's one of the things that worked for standardization and worked for basically bringing it all, original D&D was a little more, loose, go off and do what you want. This was to pull it all together. And I think the tournaments were a tool that were used to basically say, and this is D&D. And this is how we present it. This is how we're doing it. Because I'm thinking back to those briefing sessions where we pulled everybody together and said, "And this is how you're going to run it. And this is how you're going to deal with it." Thaco, to hit armor class 0, came out of the tournament scene. It wasn't something that was generated from TSR itself. It wasn't one of their ideas. It was basically a calculation that they started using as a method to quickly being able to communicate information.
Great. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. I'm so glad to hear that from you, Jeff, because when I read stuff that Gygax was writing, like in Dragon Magazine at the time, I see him make this point about standardization, and anybody in the world really ought to be able to sit down at another table and recognize D&D. I don't see him specifically talking about tournaments, but I see him talk about standardization like this. So
I think it's much more a tool that we used as opposed to, basically we created D&D to fit the tournaments. The tournaments were used to promote the standard, the AD&D system.
That makes a lot of sense. Interesting. I'm really glad to hear you share that, actually, because that definitely resolves a mystery that's been in my head for a long time. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Should we shift to comic book type stuff?
Sure.
So maybe for our viewers, for some people, Jeff's most prominent role-playing project was the original Marvel Superheroes role-playing game, which some people now refer to as Face Rip by the abilities for acronym, of course. Mm-hmm. I played that quite a bit. It's actually one of the things that sucked me into Marvel Comics. I actually wasn't reading much before that time. Mm-hmm. But all your very long amount of work on that kind of sucked me into that. We have recently, I recently introduced Paul to Marvel Face Rip on our show. We were playing in our live show on Tuesdays, and so I ran him for a couple weeks through the one solo adventure that that Bruce Nesmith wrote for Thor.
And
which is one of my favorite adventures of all time. And the fact that it's, anyway, let's not talk about that. Viewers can go watch that show if you want to see the playthrough of the Thor solo show. So one thing I'll ask, Jeff, is the game went through a number of different iterations. So there's a basic set, there was a later advanced set, there was a later revised edition. Which one is your favorite? Like, if you had to run a Marvel Superheroes game right now, which version of the game would you pick up for that?
I would go with the blue box, which is the advanced set. But I probably would not use the Ultimate Powers book, which is very good, but just, it's after my time. So
interesting.
You talk about iterations. This game started with in college with my D&D group. We had just wrapped up a major campaign and didn't feel like playing D&D, but we still wanted to role play. So we put together Project Marvel Comics, which was set in West Lafayette, Indiana, in the Marvel Universe, and had characters like Big Man on Campus and Superpin, the Pro Bowler of Steel. And one of my dungeon group was reading comics. I'd read comics as a kid, fallen out, and I got back into it in college. A friend of mine was Joe Carpiers, was basically a comic book reader. And that's about the time that, the Star Wars books came out, the Star Wars comics came out, and Howard the Duck, and a lot of very different types of comics. And sort of that drew me back into comics. And so we started running these adventures. And eventually, of course, the campaign culminated where they went to New York. They were going to, meet the mayor and fight Spider-Man. They ended up meeting Spider-Man and fighting Mayor Koch. So it was fun. And basically, I had my Purdue group, I had my Pittsburgh group, and we had a lot of. It was very light. It was very, very light. Mm-hmm. But when came to TSR, they were asking for Blue Sky projects. What do you want to do? What do you want to work on? And I gave them a cyberpunk adventure that was really dark. And they came back. It sort of like ate its way through the bottom of the filing cabinet. And they said, "What else do you want?" And I said, "Well, I got this, superhero game I've been working on." And we got the license for Marvel. And boom, it's off the races. And there were several iterations of that Universal table. Time. I mean, the Universal Table is the descendant of like the old combat CRTs, combat result tables from war games. And it was very simple. It was very colorful. It basically summarized everything into one table. And it was incredibly useful. It's one of those mechanics that I'm very, very proud of over the years. And we had a very tight deadline. You'll notice in the credits, it is co-creator, myself and Steve Winter. And Steve was my editor, but he also did most of the writing. I did most of the mechanics for that yellow box, for that original yellow set. Okay. And, based on the whole face front true believer, that's a style that we basically embraced. That was Steve. And, he did a fantastic job with it. We teamed up again on the Advanced Marvel and then on the Revised. But that's the core of where we started. But we went through, like I said, a number of iterations. I think for like, it feels like 2 years, but it was really like 6 weeks. I would come up with a new table, and Zeb Cook would take it apart and show that why it doesn't work, and then I would go back and I would start working on it again, and this is where we ended up. So
fascinating.
Yeah.
And for our viewers, Jeff mentioned the face front. The basic set is the whole thing is written in the voice of Marvel characters. So the entire rules book is either Spider-Man talking to you, or the Thing talking to you, or Doctor Doom talking to you at one point about how villains work.
And that's very much a Marvel sort of thing. There was a very direct interaction. And when I say face front true believer, that's very much the back in the 60s, you didn't know exactly who the artist was or who the writer was. And Marvel was very good at bringing its talent to the fore. King Kirby, Stan the Man Lee, the whole thing of that, that's sort of like very embracing. And, we're all in the Mighty Marvel Marching Society. It's very, very good. It's glib to some degree, but it also has a very sort of "hey, gung ho" attitude that I think we really captured in the game.
Definitely.
I must apologize. The orange cat that keeps coming in is named Kekovar. He sees when I'm online and basically, you're not typing. You can pet me now. So I apologize for Kekovar.
There's an orange cat just off screen over here. So if viewers see an orange cat walk into my frame, there's not a teleporting cat walking between the frames of the show. Just to avoid confusion before it happens.
He's a Flurkin. I mean, he's a big fat orange cat. It's like, it's like from the Captain Marvel movies. So.
Exactly. It's exactly what it looks like when he shows up over here. So speaking of the Universal Table, so one of the, there was a time in the mid-80s after the basic Marvel game came out where TSR seemed to be changing all of its games to use a table like that. So mm-hmm. when Star Frontiers, I call it Second Edition. It's under the name Zebulon's Guide to Space, right? So I call it Star Frontiers Second Edition. Changed from just a straight percentile system to a universal table with four colored gradations of success. And when TSR's Conan game came out, right? I mean, to me, it's like, why not just use D&D if you're going to play Conan? It had a custom universal table with four color gradations. I think Alternity might have worked the same way.
I think I don't think so. But Indiana Jones.
There was something else. There you go.
Indiana Jones used it. And basically, one of the ideas that you quickly is obvious is that they were looking at this as a way of being able to quickly do licenses. Okay. Conan. Which had a Jeff Butler cover. Jeff Butler was the artist for came on board as a to draw characters for Marvel, among other things. He had a very distinct style. He really nice. He did some Green Hornet stuff, which was nice. Indiana Jones had its you know its universal table. So yes, they were looking at a copy of Gamma World. Used a version of Gamma World had a universal table as well.
Our viewer John Miller just reminded us that was third edition Gamma World that did that. Thank you, John.
Oh, trouble is there's so yes, that's the one with the giant robots on the cover. I did the next one, the one for the WotC version. So with Andy Collins.
In the mid 80s it just looked like universal table mechanics were just going to take over everything. Are you surprised that it went away? I mean, so nowadays most games try to get away from any tables at all. And you know, certainly and use a formula like maybe FACO or maybe something better. instead personally, like with Marvel, I don't mind one table. Like one table, and it's on the DM screen, and I don't have to flip through a book. I'm just looking at the same thing. Seems to work very well for me. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And of course, like at the very least, the overall term universal is still with us in terms of what is this game's universal mechanic, as you know, people still say to this day. Are you surprised the table thing went away after the 80s, I think the game, as I said,
its ancestor is the CRT, is the war game.
Yeah.
You know, basically where you had the little, you roll a six-sided dice, you get DX or D2 or, you know, AX, and basically it was a very simple combat mechanic back then. And I think it's part of, you know, the evolution and the change of how games evolve. A lot of games, we've gone through a period of dice games. You know, the idea of I roll X number of dice, and for all the successes I get, they're good. Oh, we have a fumble dice. That's a D6 mechanic. You know, basically, if you roll badly there, you're gonna you know, it's going to negate everything. It's a lot of comparison with task versus difficulty. You know, ability versus difficulty, how you can basically put that all together. So there, I think that there's a lot of different ways of approaching the mechanics, and I haven't really thought about the idea of, you know, the universal table going away, but you're right. I go on long car trips with a friend sometimes, and you know, we talk about games and game mechanics. He was wondering how Marvel would be redesigned, and basically a lot of it does feel very 80s. Does feel very old school. How would we change it? And even though I think the universal table is a component of that, I probably would keep it because, again, it provides a central grounding point for everybody that they understand where their character falls. Also, and one thing that works well for the universal table, it's that expandable out to, you know, class 1000, class 3000, beyond, with the idea of different ranks and ratings, because that's a comic book sort of thing, particularly for, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s. How strong is the Hulk? Who would win the fight of the Hulk versus Thor? There was a classic Avengers Defenders War where Hulk and Thor are fighting over the hammer. They spend the entire battle just gripping onto that hammer, and they have to because otherwise they'd end the rest of the battle because they're too powerful. So
right. I think, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, having the role playing game quantify those things, and I think that you know, maybe John Peterson's actually written about this for D&D, but having the role playing game quantify those kind of things scratch that itch of those of us who were continually tantalized by that, exactly those questions. The comic could finally pick up the role-playing game, finally look up the actual concrete statistic and say, aha, the Hulk is clearly stronger. It says so right here, and finally actually answer that question.
And the era, that Marvel originally arrived in was a time when the direct sale comic book shops were just getting taking off. They were amazing. Yes. You didn't have to go depend upon the drugstore, or you could go to the Turning Page in Milwaukee, and basically you could get your comic book fix every every Friday was comic book day. So my wife and I would drive up to Milwaukee, buy comic books, go to a Chi-Chi's, and eat Mexican food and read comic books. Table for two, good light source is what we asked for. So it was but that was sort of the way it was, way it all came together at the time. So, but at the same time, the official handbooks, first of the Marvel Universe, and then for DC did their collection as well. Then there was the deluxe edition, was very much into that, defining everything about the characters. This is a story from inside the behind the scenes. We at one point said, we could do the Gamer's Guide to the Marvel Universe, the Gamer's Handbooks, because Marvel obviously has all the text. We can just download it, add the game stuff, boom, we're ready to go.
We set
it up, and then discovered that Marvel did not have it in electronic form. And none of that material that was – all those mounts of text were not in an electronic form initially. So we had to type everything in.
We
shared it back with Marvel to basically – so they would have it at the time. So we had some experiments with optical readers and, then we had to get somebody who basically had to go through and make sure everything's still scanned because it was on comic book paper. So – Marvel was great by this.
That's good to hear. I feel like that's a story that we've heard a number of times, actually, of people working with a licensor that are surprised at how little that they have, and that you have to wind up either relying on the third-party creators or a fan site or something like that. Because you're saying that with Marvel. We kind of had a little bit of that issue, Paul, when we were working on a Star Trek game many years ago, having trouble getting digital assets. And then I feel like we had another guest recently that said the exact same thing. So it's funny how it's funny how those big companies have that as kind of a little bit of a blind spot sometimes.
Well, Marvel was wonderful from the standpoint of they had a warehouse across the river where they kept all of the stats. The photo stats of all the pages and all the characters. So when I needed something, I could put in an order, and once a week or once every 2 weeks, somebody went over to the warehouse, pulled those over, took new shots, and mailed them to us. And that's one reason we had all of those characters and figures, and we could use Pete. We had original art. We had John Byrne do some of our covers. We also had a lot of pickup art we could get very effectively, and that was a good relationship. Later on, I was working on a DC project for WizKids, and I said, can you send me your Bible? And they sent me a licensing Bible, which is, and here's the shot of Wonder Woman that you're going to use if you ever, basically want to put Wonder Woman in your ad, that sort of thing. Okay. But not that whole background stuff.
Right.
Star Wars has the Holocron, which is a digital online. They sent me a CD and a password that basically, had all the core information on it, so basically you could research and find out where stuff was. And it was amusing. The novel I wrote was based on an adventure I had written for the Wizards of the Coast Star Wars game, and it had a lot to do with huts. So I went and started digging through all the hut material and discovered that everything they had was stuff that I had written 5 years before for the RPG. Now, Star Wars is great because it had lateral development. I mean, basically a lot of Star Wars was done, West End picked it up. And they did a lot of, they in the comic books did a lot of lateral development. They did a lot of stuff that was not on the screen. The expanded universe, which then Lucasfilm took and basically say, and went to its row, when it went to its right, it says, and here's what our universe is like. So Bill Slavicek created the Athorians, Hammerhead, from the original cantina scene. He's on screen for 3 seconds. You know, he's very distinctive. The whole idea of who he is, who what his race is, what they're called, all that came from Bill Slavicek and his team great. Over on West End. I should just give him this little credit. So
great,
awesome.
Yeah, licensing's fun in games.
Yeah, for sure.
You wrote the so speaking of making characters, right, and pulling material from the licensor, you wrote the Marvel file series in Dragon Magazine for many, many years, where you were presenting one or two or three or four new characters out of Marvel Comics every month. Mm-hmm. I always wondered, like, how long did it take you to like write up one established character? I would feel compelled, like, well, I better go read the last 200 issues to make sure that I have a complete comprehensive knowledge of character whatever. How long would it normally take you to write up a new character like that?
It took me about a weekend for a new character, and in part they were characters that I like. The esoteric characters, I like the, you know, the ones you don't never heard of, the Liberty Legion, or, you know, Howard the Duck, the peripheral ones, yeah. And they fit in very nicely for the Marvel file. Marvel also had us on their mailing list, so every week a pile of comics would arrive at TSR, and I would go through all the ones that I hadn't been reading, so I kept up on it's professional journals, it's keeping up on absolutely. What's going on, and then I would put them on in a manila folder with a mailing list, and we would distribute them around the office. So everybody hey, what are you doing? You're reading comics? Nope, doing research. Okay.
Yep.
That's awesome.
And when we had the DC license, they did the same thing. So now we had like two major comic companies, all of their input coming in and being distributed among the designers. So
awesome.
Great.
Before we move away from comics, the one thing I super wanted to ask about when Dan introduced that we're going to talk about comics here is the Forgotten Realms comic book.
Yes.
I'm not a big, honestly, big superhero comic guy, but the Forgotten Realms comic is one thing that I still have the complete collection sitting in my basement. Super loved it. How did that come about?
The Forgotten Realms comic book was part of the second wave. Originally, we were contacted DC. And Mike Gold over there was interested in doing a license for TSR properties, which included at the time Buck Rogers. Mm-hmm. So they were looking at eventually doing a Buck Rogers book, but they settled on originally AD&D, Gamma Rotters, and Dragonlance. And Gamma Rotters was a board game that Zeb Cook designed. It was a Gamma World type with giant kaiju monsters. So basically they launched the three of those. Gamma Rotters did okay. Dragonlance did good. AD&D got a spinoff, and Mike Fleischer wrote the first four issues of the AD&D book, and, you know, set the characters and everything, and then he was done. He wasn't going to do it anymore. So I auditioned and got what turned into issues 9 to 12 of the AD&D book. And, you know, from there, we did a spinoff with one of the characters from there to do the Forgotten Realms book. My artist was a new young artist who, you know, this was his first big DC, Rags Morales, R.A. Morales. And he's just fantastic. I've got page one, issue one hanging on the wall upstairs.
Awesome.
Of Agravar standing on a cliff diving off the edge of the Forgotten Realms. And this was just a great working relationship. He was, you know, it was, you know, a lot of, you know, again, it was about 2 weeks to, you know, write a script. And I was working, you know, Marvel style, which is you'd give him the script, he would draw stuff up, then you would figure where to put the word balloons, you know, and how the dialogue would flow based upon what was drawn, as opposed to a full script where you just send it over and basically that's the editor's worry. And it just, you know, we had a great time with it. It had happened over the time of Troubles, so we basically handled that in the Forgotten Realms.
I really want to touch on that, because we were talking earlier about, like, metagaming aspects in tournaments, and I feel like that comic is probably the most sort of on the nose I've seen of talking about the Cataclysm, right? I guess, like, second edition is coming out, and I remember, panels of Omen talking about like how Magic Missile had changed. And I thought, yes! Wow, that is so detailed.
That's meta. And that's a little bit, because we were doing, we were finishing up the first arc, what I call the first arc of the Forgotten Realms, which was ended with the Time of Troubles, with the Avatar Crisis. And that was the first big, you know, trilogy type thing. And so we folded what we had, you know, the gods walk the earth. Okay, we've got an elven god here. We can basically use him. We can basically fit this in. And it tells a side story that does not affect Midnight and Sirik and the rest of them. So it was an interesting thing. It's the idea of one of the core ethos of the realms is it's always something. It's everything's happening at once. Everything is going on. So it's such a big world Bob could be up in the Ten Towns, and Doug Niles could be in Vasa and Damara, and Ed and I are down in the Dales. And, you know, basically we're basically all telling stories that are within a larger universe. I had one rule when I was the traffic cop of the realms: don't blow up the moon. And I had two very gifted designers who tried that. You know, don't do something that requires us to mention it everywhere else.
But what about like
That's like one of those rule like laws from like some ancient culture of like. Yes. You know, I don't know. Don't throw poop at a man's third wife on Thursday. Like, was this a problem? Was this like a big problem?
Ape shall not kill ape. Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm curious on the meta aspect though. Like, how much instruction or direction were you getting that you had to or did not have to address meta level stuff within the game?
That was mine. That was mine. I'm meta. I was doing it. I got no direction for it. One of the advantages of writing the comics, of course, was I knew where the bodies were buried. I knew what was going on in the realms. I had up to the minute information, so I did not have to, you know, basically double check as much. And also, I would write a script and I would get my boss Jim Ward to approve it before I sent it to DC. And then DC would turn it around and send it back. Here's the script, and Jim would say, "Yep, that's good. I approve of it." And basically, so they got a quick turnaround because they knew in advance what I was up to.
I found it so interesting that like I feel like that's the only edition shift, and we've seen several edition changes now where rules change dramatically. But I feel like that's the only one where we really saw an attempt to address the fact that the rules of the game were changing in the fiction of the worlds.
They had the chance with third when they went to third, but they passed on it. They felt that it just would be at that point there was a lot of being crisised out, where there seemed to be every year they were basically had the horde was invading and the people of the sea were coming up and so it was just like I think there was a little bit of big ticket fatigue at that point. So.
Okay. I think we had Sean Reynolds on the show about 4 weeks back talking about that, and that their take in the third edition era was that they liked to just reinterpreting the campaign worlds. Is here's an opportunity to give our own spin or reinterpretation, but not have it baked into the fiction that the winds of magic were changing or something like that.
Exactly. And I think that's, and later on they tried the spell plague for making a change over as well.
Right. So
they have done that sort of like in-game shift every so often. And of course they jumped ahead 100 years. That was another thing.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you brought up the issue of like what was the Marvel style like actually, because coincidentally, like I at one point in my life I really really wanted to be
the Marvel way. Like a comic book.
Yeah, right. And coincidentally, I picked this up and was looking at it like yesterday, and, like completely coincidentally, I'm like, oh wow, this might possibly feed into the interview tomorrow. That might be handy to know more about that. And I was totally gonna with the way that the writer and the artist interface in here actually was one of the things I was gonna ask, because that's obviously about 10 or 12 years before you were writing, and I was wondering if the style was still the same for the Marvel method at that point. And when I see comic book writers nowadays write their scripts, are incredibly detailed. The writer is specifying the panel layout on the page, and
that's
stuff
a full
like
script
that
approach. And I would basically do the layout on the page as well. In the upper right hand corner, I drew a little picture of this is going to be the big box. Okay. This is going to be, this was more suggestions than rules because Rags would basically say no, you can do it better. Tell the story better this way, and he could lay it out and inevitably made it better. So we had one where the head cheese episode. The one where Foxy is addicted to cheese.
Yep.
That originally came out of the fact of in comic book, the business of comic books, at the time, comic books were 24 pages long. Mm-hmm. It would take an artist about, could do a page a day. Okay. 24 monthly comic book, not a lot of room for error. Not a lot of room for basically someone gets sick or someone misses a deadline or that sort of thing. So literally, we wanted to come up with a story that basically took place mostly in Foxy's head, so we would have a lot of black space.
Okay.
And Rags got the story, but he liked it so much that he started drawing all the stuff that basically we were not showing there. And so, you know, we ended up even further behind. But that particular story went very, very well. That's one of the ones I'm proud of. I mean, Jim Ward liked it so much. When he got the pencils, he hung it up outside his office so everybody could
read
it.
That's great.
So that was wonderful. And we also, talking of meta, we did the everyone wants to. The behind the scenes at the Forgotten Realms, where everybody's got computer monitors everything. That's incredibly meta, and that was a fill-in issue that Rags did after he left. So, and when we're wrapping up the series, okay, we've got this issue. Let's put it in, and you can see a lot of the TSR talent is there in that. Ed's there. Jim Lauder and I are there being lectured by Elminster on Mulholland Pops. The late Kim Yale is there. Elliot Magan, who wrote Superman novels and wrote Superman for many years. He was our editor for a while, and he's shown storming down the halls grumbling about, you know, all the stuff that's going on in the various campaign settings. We had a sign that got edited out that basically was my bosses did not approve. It basically had a big door that says "The Nine Hells Do Not Open Ever," you know, because that's when we were getting away from
the
devils. And they said, "No, you got to cover that one." Okay, fine.
I always thought the basic premise of the series of a group of adventurers who are actively seeking out artifacts to destroy or contain. I thought that was like, this just sounds like a great setup for an actual campaign. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah.
Is it at all based on an actual game that was being played anywhere? No.
Not really. The Percheron, which is a ship in Dragonlance, came out of a campaign that I was running in. That was my ship. And we had a copy of the old Chivalry and Sorceries, Biremes and Galleys, which was basically big plans of all these, you know, sailing ships. So we used that in the campaign, and then we stole it and took it over to Dragonlance when we needed it. It's because we looted heavily from our previous campaigns where we created stuff. But the Realms Master basically was, you know, basically of that flying ship type category. We wanted to be able to move them around. We wanted to be able to go from place to place very quickly. Agravar I had previous from the AD&D books. The other characters were mostly created from whole cloth. You know, they don't have a predecessor in there, so they were good characters. I really did a couple short stories with them, but that's, you know, that's long gone now. So probably Minder's
all
still
right,
around.
I apologize. I got to bring this back before we run out of time. I got to bring this back.
We got
a role play game, and for viewers, there's a little bit of a tug of war happening between Dan and Paul right at the moment about our favorite Jeff Grubb property. So I'm sorry if this ping-pongs back and forth. That's what happens on Wandering DMs. Mm-hmm. So for the last 2 weeks, I've actually written blog articles about one specific rule in the Marvel Superheroes role playing game, and that is a rule that did not exist in the first edition, but did show up in the Blue Box Advanced Edition, and that is the power stunt rule, whereby you can pay karma, get a roll to possibly use a power in a new novel way, and it gets easier the more times you try it. Now, the thing that occurred to me is that there's a bifurcation there between if you have a custom, you know, unique character that the player made up versus mm-hmm. established characters from Marvel Comics. And part of the rule says is the more times that you can spot that stunt being used in the Marvel Comics backlog, the more mm-hmm. likely it is for the character to actually use it. So are you to this day, are you happy with that rule, Jeff? And did you have players actually go through the back catalog counting occurrences in order to help them at the table?
I was very, in my campaigns, I was very easy with it. The idea of, you know, if you could say, well, Quicksilver in this issue of Avengers ran around in a circle and created a whirlwind mm-hmm. to be able to cushion someone. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. You know, but you would have a lot of stuff that would show up in the comics that basically is, sometimes it's a one shot. It's just showing off. Spider-Man makes a glider out of web fluid, you know, and that's a great image. And I think he did it once, you know, that sort of thing. Because otherwise, he's always running out of it, and you know, here's he making a glider, a hang glider. So the idea of I was very, very accommodating when I was running as far as that, if I could say yes. But most of the characters, and that was mostly most of the characters I ran were creations of the players. So they were creating their own heroes as opposed to you know, basically I'm going to run Captain America. When we did the original book, Marvel did not want to see character generation because you're licensing Marvel,
really?
You're playing Captain America and Spider-Man, and we put something in the back. And when we came down to the advanced game, they basically turned to us and say, "And one thing you must do is have character generation in there."
We're good. I mean, that was going to be my other question about which one you did more in your own games. I think that the attraction is, you know, the Marvel. I mean, one of the main selling attractions, of course, is the known Marvel characters. That's primarily the IP that the company has. And I think that the couple of times Paul and I have played, it's been at a convention situation, a one-off convention situation, and then it's probably easiest to pick up a known character. And I was wondering which one you did more, so that's interesting to hear itself.
When I was running early on, it was mostly created. I used the Marvel Universe for bad guys. I used the Marvel Universe for Spider-Man to appear. I did not and I used a random roll table. I am a fan of that. The Villains and Vigilantes had a, you know, wonderful, you know, whole table type setup. We built our own, which was, you know, very, very useful. It was very fortunate in the fact that we slotted in more complex than I'd say V&V, but much less so than Champions. Early on, I would get three different types of reviews for Marvel. I love your game. I love your game, and here's how you fix it. And I play Champions, and I buy everything you do and loot it. people were transferring from over Phase Rip into the Champion system.
Okay, great. So it sounds like when someone wanted to use a power stunt, you didn't, as the judge, you didn't literally say, "Tell me how many times you've seen in a comic book." Sounds like you didn't actually do that. Okay,
all right. I basically reasonable. Can you give me an example? You know, that was much more of the case. So.
Okay. A reasonable, judicious, and wise way of playing it. I think that's good.
Exactly.
That's good for this judge to hear.
And it's a friendly game as opposed to a tournament game. So, you know, tournament, basically you're getting a whole lot of different pieces all coming together there. Because your players have different knowledge bases. You're going to have the guy who's the encyclopedia who's read everything, and the guy who argues with the encyclopedia, basically because it makes no sense, you know. And the guy who says, "Yeah, so Captain America's got a shield, okay?" And he works for Shield.
Yeah.
Is there a connection between the two? You know. Well, actually, he no longer works for Shield because he and Nick Fury had a fight in Tales of Suspense number 16.
So. Is he friends with Superman? Right. I think he's on a team with Superman. I think. Right.
I think I remember Spider-Man and Superman teaming up once. That's a thing, right?
Happened twice. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we are just about out of time. I know that we have only barely touched the tip of the iceberg here. Of course. Any final thoughts here? Anything that we wanted to return to or didn't get to bring up?
There's a lot out there. Is there anything? I've done a lot of stuff.
Awesome.
Not really. I think we've done a lot on the tournaments. We've talked a lot about Marvel. You know, we've touched on the comic books itself. And I'm very fortunate in the fact that I've had a long history and we got a chance to work on a lot of different products. Zeb Cook always says that designers tend to have a low boredom threshold. So I'm always going off and finding the next thing that I want to work on and be a part of. You know, still doing the occasional essay. I'm still showing up for conventions every so often. But pretty much I'm, concentrating on my day job.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I think we managed to cover your stuff maybe up until like the early 90s, so you still got a couple decades to cover here.
Oh jeez. So among the things we didn't get to, Spelljammer and our friends over at WebDM actually did a really nice episode on Spelljammer a couple years back. Mm-hmm. Al Kadim. I mean, I had a bunch of other questions about Manual to Planes we didn't get to, so et cetera, et cetera. And the novels and Azure Bonds and video game work and all and on and on. So Jeff, I guess I got to ask, can we possibly get you back again someday next year, I hope?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Awesome. I'll be around.
Awesome. Excellent.
Excellent. So, any questions from the floor? Yeah, anything from the chat? So, okay.
Yeah, I guess I will ask any of our viewers who do have questions, or folks who are watching this video after the fact, please leave some questions for us in the comments section. We'll build it up, and then next time we get Jeff to reappear, we should have probably way too much to cover again, right?
Right.
Sorry to do that to you.
So please leave your questions in the comments. We'd love to hear them.
Absolutely. Okay. And if you are new to the show, remember that you can like and follow, subscribe to us, The Wandering DM, for content like this. We're on YouTube, we're on Twitch, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and we do have the handle Wandering DMs, all one word, on all of those channels. So please look for us there.
Likewise, if you prefer to listen to the show in audio-only podcast format, you can do that. It's available on our website at wanderingdms.com, as well as various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify. If you are listening to us on one of those other carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us there. We would really appreciate it.
We very much do. As always, a big, big thanks to our growing list of patrons who support the Wandering DMs channel here. If you would like to join them and support the Wandering DMs channel, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll have access to our Discord server where we have chats immediately following our talk show like we'll have today, and you'll have all the fresh news about our upcoming episodes of our tournament D&D show, The Big Bad, and we will have episode 2, The Big Bad versus East Coast Slayers Gaming Group, coming up this Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So please look for that and our other shows here on the Wandering DMs channel. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. This was invaluable, and we will need to get you back, possibly as a regular guest, because you might produce stuff faster than we can cover them on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thank you so much. Remember, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so we hope that you will join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.